Well, a hearty good afternoon to everyone. Thank you, Mr. Houck, for your request. I hope it works on me. If I fall asleep, let me know. I mentioned that to one person, and they said, well, who's going to wake me up? Can't win on this situation here. I definitely want to take the time to thank our choir and compliment them highly. Now, Mr. Brian did not want to get up and compliment the choir since he's part of the choir. But I noticed last week, and we were sitting in the back there and in the center, and it was very, very good, very impressive. So I want to thank all of the participants. I want you to know that your work and your effort is definitely appreciated and certainly paying off. It was really sounding powerful and very, very impressive, and I've been really enjoying it. Of course, half the congregation is up here, so that helps too, but nonetheless, it was very, very good, folks. And I know Jill and Will are in the choir, and they took off last year, newlyweds, you know. But they're back in it again now, and they were there last Sunday or whenever. They had to be here or somewhere practicing at 9 o'clock Sunday morning. So it's a lot of sacrifice to do it, but I just want you to know it's very much appreciated and really good quality. I also wanted to mention the fact that just one paragraph out of the hymnal letter, but you should pick up a copy and read it. Here are the highlights of it. There's two categories. Number one, there's a congregational hymnal, which will be a different color than what the member hymnal will be. Congregational hymnals will be shipped to each individual pastor after the feast. Okay? But there will also be a spiral-bound song leader and an accompanist version and so on. There will also be a CD based on the songbook sent out to all the congregations. But the member hymnals, which I don't know what he mentions a color here, but I don't see it offhand, those will be shipped to individual feast sites because it will be less expensive to ship it in bulk to individual feast sites, at least in the U.S., and then we'll be given instructions at each feast site and how to pick up our personal copies, and it's one per family, and they'll explain all of that. And they're requesting a donation as well, not required, but requested. And then there's that other announcement about people going to the, everything gets abbreviated, the PCB, Panama City Beach feast site, and for volunteers and so on. Well, today I would like to cover the subject of, which is a rather large one, Christ's return. I was asked what the title was, and I said Christ's return. Well, that's a big subject because it covers a big area. But I like to break it down into three components or three aspects of it. And the first aspect is one that we are all interested in, and people have been interested in for hundreds and hundreds of years and always have looked, well, it goes back a couple thousand years, actually, as we'll see. Everybody wants to know when Christ is going to return. We all want to kind of know, well, when's that going to be? And how many people have become self-proclaimed prophets and tried to proclaim and name the date that Jesus Christ was going to return, and they're standing up there on the top of the hill waiting for Christ to come with the people that have been conned by them. And of course, he's already collected all of their money. And when Christ doesn't come, well, that's the way life is. or people who've built compounds, you know, the Waco, Texas thing. There's another one being built down there by some other religious group. I saw a report on TV, and they were flying over it in a light plane, observing it, because it's all fenced off. No one can come in, and the only way you can view it is from the air. And they're constructing some big building and underground things, and unfortunately, it'll probably be another Waco situation eventually, because they think that Christ is going to come back there. There are people who have been in our group in the years past who have broken away, again, self-proclaimed prophets, and one group out in Utah, they think that's where Christ is going to come back to. And they always come up with some reasoning of how they can figure out the date that Christ is going to come back. Well, let's see what Jesus Christ had to say about that. And let's read here in Matthew 24, and we'll read a number of things here in Matthew 24. Pretty interesting chapter, which we have all read over and over and had it quoted to us. But let's look at it from the perspective here of the disciples, first of all, and notice the first question when they get Christ alone, and they begin to find out, or they realize, you know, that this thing of the kingdom and Christ is going to return. What is the first question they ask? Because everybody wants to know. Verse 3, and as they sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came in to him privately, you know, in a personal way, just them and Christ, saying, tell us what shall be, tell us when shall these things be? We want to know when it's going to happen. What's the date? And what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? So this was foremost on the disciples' minds. And, you know, they got into trouble with Christ because they were already figuring out who was going to be the greatest and who was going to be in charge. And someone, one of the mothers, figuring that she would beat the rest of them to the punch, immediately went to Christ before the rest could, while they were back there squabbling on who was going to be higher than the other one. She did an end run and ran right over to Christ and asked if her sons could sit on right and left hand of him, you know. Everybody's worried about when's Christ going to come back and what is their position going to be. That's the human carnal way of looking at it. And Jesus answered, and he said, take heed that no one deceive you. Now, let me ask you a question. How many of you here, I'm not going to ask how many of you believe this, I just want to know how many of you here have ever heard the comments and references to, or whatever, that Christ will return on the Day of Trumpets. How many have ever heard that? See, almost everybody. No cigar. We'll see. It sounds good, doesn't it? And it sounds logical. There's only one problem with it. It doesn't agree with what Christ said. But we need to know that, because we all kind of want to have a little insight. We keep the holy days. Feast of Trumpets represents Christ's return. Hey, it's logical. Must be the day he's coming back. Not necessarily. Okay, Christ said, make sure nobody deceives you. And verse 5, many will come in my name, saying that I am Christ, and shall deceive many. A lot of people, a lot of these self-proclaimed people, as I've mentioned, I think, before, don't say that they are Christ, but they say they are Christ's representative, and if you want to get to the Father, you have to come through them, because they are God's one and only representative on the earth. Whose position is that? That is Jesus Christ's position. So without saying it, they really put themselves in the place of Christ. You want to be in the kingdom, you got to come through me, because God set me aside as the special person here, that I'm the only one that God listens to. And they'll deceive many people, and people follow this baloney. You've got this fellow with the polygamist that's been now on TV with all of his court case there, and I guess it's in Utah, and he's embarrassing all of the Latter-day Saints by his beliefs. But all his polygamy and all the other things, it's the same thing. And people follow it. Why? I don't know, but Christ said, look out that nobody deceive you. Why? Because people can be deceived. For many shall come in my name, and so on. Okay, in verse 6, and you shall hear wars and rumors of wars. All right, we've heard of that. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in different places. We certainly are seeing some of those things, aren't we? All these, now this isn't the end. All these are the beginning of sorrows, the warm-up exercises for the future. Then shall they deliver you. Now, we haven't gotten to this stage, and I'm not looking forward to it. So I always carry the pastor's name and address in my pocket in case anybody wants to know. He's the man in charge around here. So anyway, then they shall deliver you to be afflicted and shall kill you. And this is, as we'll see in going through these, there in Revelation, Christ even delayed his coming there, as we'll see the reference, until the rest should be killed, martyred. This is evidently an important part here of witnessing to people who are going to be resurrected later on. And you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. I won't elaborate on that, but now we can understand how we could be hated by all nations because of the communication that's around. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And we really haven't seen this type of thing as far as within the church, but you see the potential for it. And many false prophets or preachers or self-proclaimed shall arise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. A witness now, not a conversion. Always remember that. Our job is to witness to the world. Some people, some few, will respond. But the main purpose is to witness to the world so that when Christ does come back, no one is going to be able to stand up in front of God and say, well, God, if you would have only told us, we would have done it. And God will say, I did, but you wouldn't listen. So it's going to be a witness unto all nations, and how that will take place, you know, you can throw in the two witnesses and whatever is going to be taking place there throughout the world, but all nations are going to be aware of this. And then shall the end come. Now let's drop down to verse 32. Christ's going to give us some advice here. He said, now learn a parable. Learn from this thing. I'm going to give you an example and gain some wisdom here about the question you asked me in reference here to the disciples of when am I going to return? Learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So when the spring comes and the leaves start coming out, you know that summer is just around the corner. Now that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Then it says, so likewise, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the door. However, he doesn't say you're going to know when it's going to happen. So likewise, when you see all these things, this is kind of an overview outline of some of the things that will be taking place. I didn't read these other things, which we will hear in a minute. It just kind of gives us a heads up that you know that the season, it's getting close. The time is beginning to narrow down, and this is the first time I realized this, in verse 34, truly I say to you, in other words, he's saying, when this situation begins to fulfill itself, and you'll be aware of it, we'll all realize that these things that he predicted are happening, know that it's very near. However, and he also says this generation, in other words, the generation at that time will not pass away until all things be fulfilled. So once a bunch of these things really start happening in a serious way, we know that the current generation, in other words, within that period of time, 20, 30 years, 40 years, whatever, it's going to happen sometime during that period. However, he goes on to say in verse 35, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knows no man. No, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only. How can we say that Christ would return on the Feast of Trumpets? You can't say that. Christ said, you're not going to know the day or the hour. I believe him. Then he goes over verse 42. He gives us more examples there of the way that the life is going to be at the time that was going to be similar to Noah, and everything's going to be going along. And, you know, at that time, they didn't realize it until they were in the flood. Watch, verse 42, therefore. In other words, always be alert. Even though you may know that it's getting close and that it's in that season, for you do not know the hour your Lord comes. It says only the Father knows the day and the hour. Now, if God chooses to do it that way, he's got 365 days to choose from, fine. But we know that Trumpets does represent Christ's return, and we know that's all part of God's plan. And it's a very significant thing for us, because spring holy days represent, you know, the repentance and putting sin out and being baptized, and then Pentecost, of the starting of the New Testament church, and us being able, as a result of repentance, receive God's Holy Spirit. And, you know, and because of Christ's sacrifice and so on. And now the next big event that we're all waiting for is what this day represents, Christ's return. But the more I read some of these prophecies and I look at the world, even though we see terrible things happening and prophecy marching along, a lot of things still have to happen, as we will see. And those aren't going to be very nice things. And not too enjoyable. So it's there's not going to be any question when that time gets really close. But we're still not going to know exactly, and that's why he said, you don't know the hour. So keep your eyes open, don't relax, keep pushing forward. All right, the second aspect of Christ's return, what is the lead up? What leads up to Christ's return? What kind of, and I'm talking short-term type of things, things that are going to be very close to the return of Jesus Christ, as Christ mentions here, even within a generation. Okay, let's go back and read verse 15. When you therefore shall see the abomination, now he's getting much more specific. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, has this taken place in this current period of time? No, not that we're aware of. Although people, again, are speculating and whatever. However this is to take place, it will be very clear to us. It probably will not take place in the way we are imagining right now, because we don't have the circumstances and the facts haven't presented themselves to know exactly the details of what's going to happen. But he said, when this abomination is set up, flee, get out of there. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field, returned back to his place to get his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child and them that give suck in those days, but pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. Now that gives an indication that whatever is taking place here or about to take place is going to be pretty bad. Doesn't tell you what's happening, doesn't give you the details of why you need to flee. It just says it's not going to be very good. Verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation. We haven't lived through great tribulation, but prior to Christ's coming, there is going to be great tribulation. That will go back to verse 10, where it talks about many are offended and they'll betray one another. It also goes back to verse 9, where we are going to be hated of all nations and some of us shall be killed. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. Now that is going to be pretty bad tribulation. Think about Rome. How many of you have ever been to the Colosseum in Rome? Well, quite a few of you, because of feasts and so on. The Christians were killed there, martyred there. Whether they were true Christians or not, I don't know. But I am sure that many true Christians were. It seems to indicate that from history. And that wasn't the only place they were ever martyred and killed. There were many other places. That was pretty bad. I mean, when hundreds of thousands of people were sitting around cheering and yelling, and hungry lions were released, and people were devoured and torn apart before the eyes of the spectators, or burned at the stake, and on it goes. And you would think, well, that's a pretty bad tribulation. But Christ said, it's going to be worse than that. It says, such as not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And the reason it won't be any worse than this is because Christ is going to return to stop everything. But this is what's going to be taking place very prior, close close proximity is what I'm trying to say, to Christ's return. This is the lead up to Christ's return. Things aren't going to be being stretched out so much and just preparing, but it seems as based on what the Bible's saying here, that things are going to become pretty compressed. And one thing after another is going to begin happening. It says, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Because if they weren't shortened, man would probably annihilate himself. People's attitude, we were talking coming down here today, is just very into themselves. And they take care of themselves first. And they don't care. I mean, I unfortunately have to do a lot of driving. And people's personality, if you have to drive a lot, comes out. And they're driving. And they're on the phone. And they're this. I mean, they're all over the highway. And it gets very frustrating. Especially when your own life is endangered by their lack of attention and their actions. But they're just in their own world. The ultimate example of that would be a group of teenagers who are standing in the middle of the street in a circle or around and talking, and they're totally oblivious to anything around them because they're with their friends. And we have to talk and we have to visit. This is the most important. And they could be run over by a truck and nobody noted the difference. I mean, it's just really, really something. Because that's so important to them, is their friends and their communication. And, of course, then it extends on into adults the same way. That's why it says, because the iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. The natural, compassion and concern for one another will just become very hardened. But those things haven't developed, the Great Tribulation is not upon us right now. We don't have any records that I'm aware of right now that where our brethren are being murdered or killed because of what they believe. And, you know, it's not that kind of a situation. But it is going to happen. And when it does, you know, time is getting pretty short. Let's go back to, well, let's continue here. Again, he warns about verse 24. Well, he's talking about not believing in verse 23 when people say that Christ is over here, Christ is over there. Again, there are going to be many false Christs, people who say they represent God because that's what Christ does, you know. Christ is the God the Father's representative. And there are going to be a lot of people claiming to represent Christ and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders. It won't just be their mouth flapping, but it will be things they will be doing that Satan will be supporting them in. Insomuch that if it were possible, they should deceive the very elect. Those of us who understand will, of course, recognize where that is coming from and why it is wrong. And he's giving us a heads up, verse 25. He said, behold, I've told you before. In other words, I'm telling you in advance, this is what's going to happen. So you should recognize it when it takes place and you won't be deceived. Wherefore, if they'll say that I'm over in the desert and so on and so forth, don't believe it. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, immediately after. So these things are going to be happening in very quick succession. Shall the sun be darkened? Now this is very interesting because you go over to Zechariah 14, which we'll read later, and it talks about when Christ returns, there's going to be no night. It says at night, there's going to be daylight. And he goes, if you read back in verse 27, for as lightning comes out of the east and shines to the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. There's going to be light everywhere, 24 hours a day. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, verse 29, the sun first, before this light comes, is going to be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven. And we'll, back in Revelation, it indicates that big meteors are going to hit the earth. And the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Great glory and great power. And they'll know that there's great power, because it's going to be like lightning from east to west. There's not going to be any question where Christ is. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. We were hearing prelude of that in the sermonette. Now learn a parable, as we already read, of the fig tree. This is what is going to be preceding Christ's return. This isn't Christ's return yet. These are the things that are going to lead up to it and are going to be in, you know, quick succession before. Go to Revelation, the 6th chapter. Again, Christ here has not returned yet. But this is what it's going to take the world, and we were talking about this on the way down as well. You think about it. I mean, this is we're going to read some pretty brutal things. And it is going, evidently, to take some awesome power. He's going to return, we just read, with power and great glory. We're going to see God's power. The whole world will see God's power. And it's going to be pretty brutal. Evidently, that's what it's going to take to get through to people on this earth, because they will be hardened and inured to others' concerns, you know, natural affection and all these other things. And it's going to take something, because these false prophets are going to have set themselves up. They have bewitched the world. They've deceived everybody. And they have everybody in awe. This power is going to be so much more powerful, and there are going to be so many more horrible things taking place, that is just going to pale that into insignificance. In verse 1 here of chapter 6 begins the seals. This is in Revelation. And the first one, of course, is false religion. And then the next one, verse 3, is the second seal, and that's a red horse. And this one goes out to take, it says, thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and that there should be given to him a great sword. So people will be attacking one another, killing one another. Again, this is only the beginning. Then the next seal, a black horse. And now it indicates that there is going to be famine and lack of things because of the indication of the balances here. Then the fourth one in verse 7, disease. And let's see, he says, and the power was given unto him, towards the end of verse 8, over the fourth part of the earth. 25% of the earth to kill with the sword and with hunger and with death and with beasts of the earth. Right now we have a little tiny foretaste from, you know, this country was rid of all of the beasts that could hurt you, you know, the bears and the wolves and all of this. But of course the animal people want to reintroduce the wolves and the coyotes, and there used to be a bounty on coyotes. You'd sit out there with a recording of a squealing rabbit, and when the coyotes came in, you would shoot the coyote, and you'd get a $5 bounty for the pelt. Now, if you tried to do that, they'd probably throw you in jail. Of course, the coyotes are now attacking little children and doing other things which we didn't have to worry about before, but we have coyotes back. We're so lucky. Okay, the wild beasts of the earth, if you read and heard stories of the bears up in Alaska, or the early pioneers and the mountain men going out into the to the mountains with the grizzlies, you know, they always tell the stories of the grizzly attacking the people because there were a lot of grizzlies around. Grizzlies didn't know who we were. They weren't necessarily interested in eating us. They just knew you were another big thing in the forest, which meant you are competition for my food, and I'm going to get rid of you. Or, of course, if it was a threat to their cubs or anything. And then verse 9 talks about the great tribulation. And he said, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. They were killed because of what they believed. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said to them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. You can think about that. And then the sixth seal. Now, all of these things continue to get worse and worse and worse on the earth. These things are happening in very minor ways in comparison to the way they are going to be. And then in verse 12, we start the heavenly signs, and there are going to be great earthquakes. Now, we're getting more and more earthquakes. They're not nice. Anybody who's lived in Southern California when we had that series of earthquakes here years back, it can really get to you. When the earth starts moving under your feet, it does things to your head. Nothing, you know, you talk about, well, I want my feet down on terra firma. Well, when terra isn't very firma, then, you know, you're not, it really shakes you up. There were great earthquakes, and the sun became black as sackcloth. Now, we read about that in Matthew 24. And the moon became as blood. And what could cause that? Well, we know if giant volcanoes go off, it can blacken out the sun. It can turn the moon to blood. You know, it can make it look bloody. And the stars of heaven fell to the earth. Now, we have scientists who are worried about these asteroids and so on. Well, evidently, in the future, that is going to happen. even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. So everything is going to be disturbed. And you think about a fig tree here, and it's got the figs on it waiting to be harvested, and a mighty wind comes along and knocks off all of the figs. It isn't just one fig, a whole bunch of them. And that's what he's comparing the amount, the number of the stars of heaven coming down and hitting the earth. And the heaven departed as a scroll, and it rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. This has got to be attention getting here. We aren't having this kind of thing now. But this is what is going to happen just prior to Christ's return. The kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and every freeman, they hide themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Now, it's kind of jumping ahead here, but it's right when Christ is preparing to enter the scene. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? Now, I'm not going back into Revelation and reading about the church having to flee to a place of safety, about Satan being cast down to the earth, and going after the church and so on. All that'll have, that's all the behind the scenes of what causes the tribulation and so on. But this is God beginning to intervene. Man does his thing. God uses these armies and so on, and we'd have to get into a long study on that, which we've just gone through here in Revelation. But there's going to be a lot of blood. There's going to be a lot of death. There are going to be unbelievable things happening in the world. And it's going to be pretty impressive. The next chapter here talks about sealing of the 144,000, the great innumerable multitude. And then verse 8, or chapter 8, the seventh trump, the seventh seal, and that breaks, or the seventh seal, and then it breaks down into the seven trumpets and the last three woes. It's, well, look in verse 7 here of chapter 8. First angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and there were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the trees was burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. And the second angel sounded, and now think about this. This is, I was reading this and trying to, be able to try to explain this, but it's pretty simple already to understand. The second angel sounded, as it were a great mountain burning with fire. Well, that is a huge volcano. And it was cast into the sea. It blew up. And as a result, a third of the sea. Now, it doesn't say what sea. I don't know if it means all the seas. But a third of the sea, we'll just have to assume that combined oceans, a third became blood, or in other words, all red, with this volcano that was cast into the sea. How big a volcano is that? It must be pretty big. And a third part of the creatures that were in the sea and had life died. And a third part of the ships that were in the sea, they were destroyed. So it's a current day type situation with ships on the ocean. That would get people's attention. That would be on the news, if there's any news people left to report it. And then another angel comes down in verse 10, and here is the giant asteroid. Now, and we've all seen these things on TV explaining if an asteroid of a certain size were to crash into the earth, this is the result. Huge tidal waves, giant explosion, annihilation, so much greater than any atomic bomb. There is no comparison. Now, the verse 10 says, and there fell a great star. How big is a great star? I don't know, but he used the word great, so it must be a pretty good size. A great star fell from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. That's a pretty good description of an asteroid. And it fell upon one upon a third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of water. So it sounds like it landed on the land, not just the sea. And of course, if that happens, it would really, really mess things up. And the name of the star called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters, I'm assuming there he's indicating fresh water, became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And so on it goes. Verse 12, I mean, you can see how all these things work together, because when the sun is darkened, the moon turns to blood, it coincides with these things that are actually happening. He gives more detail here on how those, why the sun would go black. And the fourth angel sounded, a third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld, and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe. You mean there's more? And the answer is, yep, and it gets worse. And we have the three woes, which I'm not going to go through in detail. But it's not good. It's not good. Now, we aren't living through anything like this. And then in chapter 11, we get into the two witnesses. And then finally, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but we actually get to Christ's actual return. Okay, let's read here in chapter 11. And we'll start in about verse 14. The second woe is past, and behold, the third woe comes quickly. And the third woe is the beginning of the return of Jesus Christ. And it will be the culmination of all these things that have been happening in pretty quick succession. There won't be any question that wild, crazy things are taking place. Tribulation has taken place, and all of these signs and wonders in the heaven are going to be coming down on the people of the earth, and the great men are going to be hiding in caves, wanting the rocks to fall on them. Just think about that. All of these great leaders, all these self-proclaimed prophets, all the leaders who have been up there leading the people in the wrong direction, deceiving them, hiding like little kids in the dens and in the rocks and in the holes, and asking for the things to just kill them because they can't stand all of the things that are taking place, the earthquakes, the giant fires, the smoke. God's going to get people's attention, brethren, and it's going to have to be very, very powerful, because they will have been deeply and greatly deceived. And this is going to have to be so much more powerful and so much more impressive than what they have been led to believe, that there is not going to be any question who is in charge. And so, the third woe is about to happen. And this is the beginning, literally, of Christ's return. And the seventh angel sounded, verse 15 of chapter 11. And there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders which sat before God in their seats fell upon their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give you thanks, O Lord Almighty, which are and was and are to come, because you have taken to you your great power and have reigned. In other words, Christ hasn't taken that great power to himself yet, but he is doing it now, and he certainly is worthy of that honor and that power and that responsibility. And the nations were angry. They were not happy about this idea. And your wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that you should give reward to your servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear your name, small and great, and should destroy them which destroy the earth. So God is going to make things right. He's going to reward those people and those servants who were killed for what they believed and the way they lived and the fact that they understood the truth of God and stood up for that. But he's going to take care of and destroy those people who are destroying the earth or corrupting the earth. And that is going to be evened out. And the temple of God was opened in heaven. And there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament, the truth, the commandments, the laws and rules of God which will never die. When that heaven opened, in other words, it's there, you and I can't see it, but it indicates here when you read this, and the temple of God was opened in heaven. Suddenly, we saw, people could see what was there in heaven all the time. And what was there? People are looking for the lost ark. Well, here it is. This is where it is. I don't know where the pieces of wood are rotting or whatever, but this is where the ark or the truth is. And there was seen in his temple the ark of the testament. And there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and earthquake and great hail. And we know 100-pound hail comes down in part of these plagues. That's a pretty impressive thing. That's the preparation. That's to get people's attention. If people's attention hasn't been acquired at this point, there's really not a lot of hope for anybody. So their attention is now riveted on what is going on, and the heaven is open, and the lightning, he says, and the hail and all of these things, lightning from east to west, and the world lights up. It was darkened, there was smoke and all these things, and suddenly all that goes away and everybody sees this incredible power of light and brightness. And then something else happens. Let's go back here for the third phase of Christ's actual return. And this was referred to, not read, but referred to in 1 Thessalonians 4. He says in verse 14, 1 Thessalonians 4, "For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him." And we know the choir sings a hymn similar to this and uses these words. I wanted to stand up and shout, you know, this morning, because I'm talking about Christ's return. That's the only hope we have. That's it. I mean, it certainly isn't going to work with this world. I mean, people will say exactly, I think I mentioned this already earlier, "No, God, if you would have just given us a little more time, just a little more time, we would have worked it out." And he said in Matthew 24 that if he was given a little more time, there wouldn't be anything left. If Christ is going to tell them, "If I gave you any more time, there wouldn't be anything left to work out." Christ has to come back and save man from himself. There is no way that man can live at peace together. Has there ever been? I mean, even in our short lives, you can look back starting in, you know, World War II, and during the 50s, there were a few years, 4 or 5 years, when there was so-called peace, when there weren't major powers trying to fight one another. The beginning, a little bit beginning of the Vietnam War was starting up in the 50s. But with the exception of that and some little skirmishes here and there, it was relative peace. But how long was that? 5 years? 7 or 8 years? And then we got into the Vietnam War, and then, of course, there are other nations, you know, like Iran and Iraq battled each other for how many years? 10 years? I don't know. Thousands and thousands of people died in this long ongoing war. Some people live and die, and they're always at war, fighting with some other tribes or whatever. They just don't know anything else except war. No, man can't live in peace. It's not possible. Somebody always wants to take advantage of somebody else, and then those people fight back, and it just goes on and on and on. And of course, you have the ultimate power there on this earth, this in the form of Satan, whose objective, brethren, is to destroy humanity. That's what he wants to do. And he wants to turn the earth back to God in a smoking cinder, as a smoking cinder, and say, well, here you go, God. Here's your creation. Look what I did to it. I get rid of all those potential gods. I got them all messed up. I twisted their minds. I got them fighting one another and hating one another, and all these other things that were taking place. And see, it doesn't work. Your way doesn't work. Well, God's going to intervene at the last possible moment. But when he does, all of these things have to happen in order to get the earth's attention. And we'll only understand that if we're still living at that time. It won't be a very pleasant time, but we will, if we are living at that time, we'll understand why these things are happening, and it will be very encouraging, because we know it won't be long before Christ is going to be there. It's an amazing, amazing thing here. All right, and so here in 1 Thessalonians 4:14, it says, "For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive," and this is what's going to happen now that Christ is ready to descend. The clouds open, the heavens open, you see the truth, the ark of God there, and this is also going to happen. "We which remain alive, or alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord, shall not precede them which are asleep," as we heard in the sermonette. "For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first." And that is going to be a great time. "Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words." We're going to need to understand and remember this, brethren, because if you and I are alive at the time when all these things are happening, we're going to need some comfort. Look forward to what is taking place. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15 here real quick. I love this, the way Paul explains this. Verse 51. "Behold," 1 Corinthians 15:51. "Behold, I show you a mystery. The world does not understand this. Only we understand this." We have to have the Spirit of God. We have to be converted. We have to understand this book, which we can't do without God's Spirit. "I'm going to show you a mystery, a secret," Paul says. "We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed." And he talks about, in verse 54, towards the end, he says, "Then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law." And this is what's going to transpire right as Jesus Christ is about to descend out of heaven and come down. Well, go to Revelation 19, because this describes the actual descent of Christ. Revelation 19. Won't read the whole chapter, just we'll start here in verse 11. "And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. In righteousness he does judge and make war." Now this is, he is going to be making war, brethren, as he returns. "His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. Now, the people with him are the ones who we read about who were martyred and killed and were resurrected. And then those who remained alive were changed. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations. This is not going to be a peaceful return. Christ is going to be at war, and he is going to be straightening things out. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the wine winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God. And that's a fierceness and a wrath that you don't want to have any part in. And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Even though other people have tried to claim that title, to be the king or the representative of God, this is the real king. And he's going to have, that name is going to be written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Anybody want to disagree with it, he's going to say? Because when he returns, it's not going to be pretty for anybody who resists him. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourselves together unto the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of captains and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses, of them that sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, both small and great. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast that was taken, and with him the false prophet, the big boys, the guys who are now don't look so big anymore. They don't have King of Kings and Lord of Lords written on their jacket, that wrought miracles before him, and with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. End of problem. And the remnant, remember back in verse 15, and in his mouth goes forth a sharp sword that he makes war with. And in verse 21, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeds out of his mouth. And we're going to be there as part of his army with him. And all of the fowls were filled with their flesh. Not a gentle return of Jesus Christ, but a powerful one. And one that is not going to be missed by anybody. And finally, if you go over one more chapter there, this verse was already read, part of it. Verse 4, and it says, God is going to establish his kingdom, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. For the first time, all the suffering of mankind, which is going on right now in this world, people are dying, people are suffering, people are dying of disease, of AIDS. I have seen people die of AIDS. Brethren, you do not want to die of AIDS. That's just one thing. There are other types of diseases that consume your body, and it's just awful, awful things. There's not going to be any more tears. There's not going to be any more death. There's not going to be any more weeping and sorrow over loved ones dying and crying. Neither shall there be any more pain. Those things are gone. And he that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true, and they're faithful. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst, the people who yearn for God's way, of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcomes. This was read this morning by Brian. He that overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son.